Jobs Day Friday, a global economic summit all over the news. Come on, doesn't get any better than that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 7th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We will stipulate as we get going here that the jobs report this morning was pretty good. Very good, one might even say. A net 222,000 people got jobs last month in all kinds of industries, too. Healthcare, education, mining, and construction. Unemployment rose a hair to 4.4%, but in a good way because a lot of people entered the labor force looking for work. However, just because it seems we are not allowed to have unvarnished good economic news anymore, wages. Average hourly earnings were barely up in June, the latest in a long line of tepid monthly increases, which just isn't the way things are supposed to be working right now. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to figure out what gives.
What's supposed to happen when unemployment's very low and employers are trying desperately to fill jobs?
Good old-fashioned supply and demand economics 101 would say pay more and solve your supply shortage.
Though economist Mark Fleming at First American Title says Economics 101 seems to be on vacation right now. Employers complain they can't find qualified workers to hire, and yet they aren't raising wages much above inflation to get the workers they need. Darlene Miller is one of those employers. She runs Permac Industries outside Minneapolis, and she really needs to hire more precision machine tool operators. She says she is raising pay, but not any more than the competition.
You know, people are not going to jump ship if they're in a good job, $4, $2 an hour raise.
And she says she can't raise wages so much that her products become uncompetitive in an economy where inflation is low and increased costs are hard to pass on. Economist Mark Fleming says building contractors complain about a shortage of skilled construction workers, but they aren't hiking wages above the national average either.
There's reticence to increase wages because it makes construction of needed first-time home buyer homes economically infeasible.
Kathy Barrera, chief economic advisor at ZipRecruiter, sees a job market still scarred by the Great Recession. She says employers have been spoiled by years of having the upper hand.
Employers had their pick of workers, sort of been used to not having to raise their wages a whole lot and still be able to find workers.
She says wait a while. In this tight labor market, she's pretty sure wage increases will come. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This being a Friday and there being more going on than just jobs, we're going to take the next four or so minutes of live radio to dissect the economic week that was. Anna Swanson is with the Washington Post. Sudeep Reddy is with Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sudeep, given what Mitchell had to say, let me just ask for a little extrapolation on wages and how much room the job market has left to tighten yet. Because, I mean, we talk about full employment, but maybe we're not really there.
Maybe we're not there. This week, we entered the ninth year of the economic expansion. I don't think any of us expected to have come through this long without being knocked down by all the economic and political and security crises we've faced around the world for 8 years. So that alone is an accomplishment, but it's also been a remarkably mediocre stretch of time. So it kind of suggests an underlying malaise to go that long without seeing a pickup in wage growth, pickup in overall inflation. It just points to really weak demand and a subdued nature to the economy that we just can't seem to pop out of, even if we're getting steady growth in jobs.
Anna, your gut on the duration of this recovery then and what it means for the job market, we're just stuck here.
Right. Well, as I think our friend Janet Yellen says, recoveries don't necessarily die of old age,
right?
So we could see this mediocre recovery go on for a while, and it certainly has been. You know, economists have been pretty surprised by how resilient this job market looks. We've been adding jobs at a very steady clip for, you know, eight years now. But the economy still looks kind of remarkably like it did last year. And I think that's one thing to note, you know, that the presidency may have changed political parties, but the economy hasn't. It still looks pretty similar under President Trump as it did in the past few years.
Right. All right. So, Sudeep, to overseas and the president being in Hamburg at the G20, the 20 biggest economies in the world, ostensibly about global trade and sustainability and all of this. I wonder, though, if you expect anything tangible to come out of this summit.
We probably won't see tangible policy coming out of a summit like this, but these gatherings are really useful for how countries calibrate their positions and what this tees up down the road. This is a very striking difference in this summit and how far apart the U.S. is from every other country. At least most of them had been coming together, partly due to U.S. Guidance to try to bring these 20 economies together. And now this is the big test for the go-it-alone approach from the Trump team. There's a reason U.S. governments have avoided that approach for the last seven decades. We kind of have to just see whether this will lead to the great trade wars of 2017 or just more bluster and a lot of talk, but not a whole lot of follow through. That's the big question that's on the minds of everyone coming out of that summit.
Well, so along those lines, Anna, I want to play you a piece of tape here. It's audio from the president's weekly address that he taped clearly before he left. It ran about 2.5 minutes, the whole thing did. And he got to talking about his trade policy and how he's going to fix it and how it's going to be better, by gosh. And at one point he said this. Here we go.
And that's why we are pursuing a total renegotiation of NAFTA. And if we don't get it, we will terminate, that is, end NAFTA forever.
A little reality check there. As the president is in a multilateral environment over in Hamburg, he is saying another thing back home.
Right. Well, and I think with NAFTA, that's going to be incredibly complicated. The government has been receiving comments on NAFTA, and they've received thousands of public comments since they said that they were going to negotiate this deal. And a lot of pushback from interested industries, especially, you know, some of the people in the Midwest that were some of President Trump's biggest supporters, agriculture and industry. So, you know, with this isolationist rhetoric, I mean, it does seem like this is the closest that the world has perhaps been to a trade war in a long time. We're hearing rumors about how other countries are, you know, drawing up lists. How they might retaliate to hit the U.S. where it could hurt most.
Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Anna Swanson's at The Washington Post. They are both in our studios in the nation's capital. Thanks, you two. Have a nice weekend, huh?
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
All right, take it easy. On Wall Street today, yesterday's losses are today's gains. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We are still a long way from done on the federal budget for the coming fiscal year, but the initial proposal from the White House had some not great news for residents of the Great Lakes Basin. Longstanding plans to clean up industrial pollution in the biggest freshwater system in the world have been zeroed out, money that would have been spent remedying more than 40 trouble spots around the lakes. Dan Crocker from Minnesota Public Radio reports that one of the biggest of them sits at the headwaters of Lake Superior.
100 years ago, U.S. Steel built a massive mill along the banks of the St. Louis River, about 10 miles southwest of downtown Duluth, where it flows into the giant lake. For decades, the plant provided great jobs, but along with logging mills and other industries that once lined the river, it also left behind a long legacy of pollution.
And they pumped all their sludge and stuff from the coke ovens just up here, I'll show you.
Rob Moss steers his fishing boat upriver to the site of the old Duluth Works, where he worked a half century ago making barbed wire that was shipped to Vietnam. He raised his kids just blocks from the river.
I used to come down here and fish with them off the point and stuff here just to catch fish, but you couldn't. You'd take them home if you cooked them, you'd all stunk. You know, they just smelled terrible. You could tell they weren't healthy or clean.
Since then, the river has made a remarkable comeback, thanks in large part to a new sewage treatment plant. Moss is 71 now, and he fishes the river more than 200 days a year, and he's even able to eat much of what he catches. But toxic contaminants still remain trapped in the river sediment.
And so this whole delta area is contaminated sediment.
Mike Bars with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency points out where the steel mill once stood. One of the byproducts of steelmaking was coal tar, which washed into the river.
And it's up to 17 feet thick in some places.
Of sediment?
Of contaminated sediment.
Altogether, there's enough contaminated muck to fill more than 800 Olympic-sized swimming pools.
It's really hard to see contamination that's under the water. But this is what it's all about. It's in the aquatic ecosystem, and it really is causing some major issues.
Barr says the pollution kills microscopic critters living in that muck that form the base of the food chain. Clean that up, and all the bigger fish and wildlife can thrive. That prospect has Rob Moss excited.
I use it. I use it every day. And I have people that come and fish with me from California, Las Vegas, Florida, all over the country. And they can't believe when you're out here, you don't even know you're by a city.
It's taken several years, but the EPA and U.S. Steel have finalized a $69 million plan to clean up the sediment. They'll each cover about half the cost. But now that deal is in jeopardy. President Trump's proposed budget to Congress calls for cutting the $300 million Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Dredging and capping the U.S. steel pollution is just one part of a broader plan to clean up the entire St. Louis River estuary by 2020 that's been 30 years in the making. And it's gotten bipartisan support. The Republican-controlled state legislature recently approved $24 million in state funding to aid in the cleanup. The EPA says if funding comes through, work on the U.S. steel project is scheduled to begin next fall. U.S. Steel would only say it can't speculate about future federal funding. But the city of Duluth is banking on it. It has an ambitious $50 million plan to revitalize the riverfront to spark new development. Director of Public Administration Jim Philby Williams says that's dependent on the river first getting cleaned up.
The foundation of all we hope to achieve for our community along the river is completed restoration of the river.
A restoration that's now in doubt. In Duluth, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So that is the greatest woman soccer player of all time, supervising a bunch of kids.
Summer camps are up in their game, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 94 points today, about 0.4%, 21,414 for the blue chips. NASDAQ up 63 points, about 1%, 6153. The S&P 500 up 15 points, 0.6%, 2425. For the week, the Dow up 0.3%, NASDAQ up 0.2%, S&P 500 up less than 0.1%. There was news in the energy sector that the utility Southern Company's efforts to convert a Mississippi plant to clean coal has run out of steam. Regulators say the plant needs to go with a natural gas fire generator instead. Southern unplugged less than 0.1% today. Con Ed, Consolidated Edison, powered up 0.1% today. Leaders, as we said, of the group of 20 countries meeting in Hamburg, Germany today, agreed to push internet service providers to improve detection and removal of extremist content from the web. Comcast clicked up 0.8% today. Verizon basically flat. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.38%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Were I to ask you to name the world's most profitable technology company, an outfit out of Cupertino, California would probably be your gut response. Am I right? And yet, Apple is not number one at the moment. South Korea's Samsung, which until not too long ago was still crawling out from under a mountain of bad press from those exploding Galaxy Note 7s, has bounced back with its most profitable quarter yet. And as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, there may be even better days ahead.
Even at the depths of its battery-catching-fire PR despair, things were never quite as dire at Samsung as they seemed. For one, Samsung still had two other profitable smartphones, and its booming semiconductor chip department more than offset the damage.
Their chip business is now valued higher than Intel itself, so this has been a real significant success for them.
Troy Stangarone is a senior director at the Korea Economic Institute. He says Samsung will continue to supply memory chips for Apple, as well as new OLED displays for the forthcoming iPhone 8.
So anytime someone buys an iPhone, Samsung profits.
The company announced today that it raked in a Q2 profit of $12.1 billion, a record, and like a phoenix rising from the ashes of its predecessor, the new Galaxy S8 is also a hit with customers.
They've produced a first-class device that, by all accounts, is doing quite well.
Will Stefega is director of mobile phone research at IDC. In addition to the S8, Stefega says Samsung will release a much-upgraded Note 8 later this fall, which will compete head-to-head with the new iPhone.
I think what it's done in many cases is given back Samsung's sort of confidence in itself and the people that buy Samsung products. that they're back on track.
Stofega also notes that Samsung already leads the way in other product lines, such as TV displays and smart appliances, and is even branching into the medical equipment industry. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Don't click on links or attachments that you don't recognize. How many times have you been told that by the IT shop at the office? Lots, right? Phishing attacks are the concern here. Malware or hacking that could lead to no good at all. And yet sometimes the temptation to click is just too great, which is part of why Lily Hain Newman, who covers security for Wired, handed over both her work and personal emails to a company called PhishMe that simulates phishing scams as a way to train people on what not to click on. And she told them to have at it. We got her on Skype. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you do this? Was this just like experiential reporting or what?
Yeah, you know, glutton for punishment, that type of thing. I think the truth is we're all sort of in one of these simulations all the time. And I hate to say that, but I wanted to just sort of take it to a logical extreme and learn a little more about what that's like.
How did it go for you then? I mean, you wake up, you check your email, as we all do. And what was the paranoia like, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, it was real. Every morning I would look at my emails and just have this really heightened awareness, knowing this could be happening at any moment. I was very paranoid and very on edge, I think.
So did you get phished, as it were?
So my just fear about getting duped actually did end up protecting me, and I didn't download anything like a malicious attachment. But it's a mixed bag because I did open every single email they sent.
Oh, that can't be good.
Right. So in itself, I was definitely opening the door. And sometimes I would kind of suspect, like, I'm pretty sure I didn't order anything from Amazon this week. But I was
compelled to
look at it anyway because I was just thinking to myself, like, what if somebody did get into my account, or what if my doctor really does have a prescription I need to fill, or, you know, whatever it is, just in spite of your better judgment, you're just so tempted.
So with the potential consequences being so high, and one need look no further than the DNC, which back during the election, that whole thing was a result of a phishing attack.
Right.
What is one to do?
Yeah, so I think awareness is helpful. There is a healthy dose of paranoia without getting too tinfoil hat that actually does help, because a lot of phishing experts talk about following your gut. If something feels weird, not to push through and ignore it, because really phishers are generally trying to create a sense of urgency, or the free airline tickets are only available for the next 100 people, you know, something like that. And that can really work. You know, it's funny, but it just exploits something that's in all of us. So I think that there is a way you can help yourself by, any time you're feeling that pull, taking a step back.
I actually was surprised to learn the other day, and I've worked at Marketplace for a long time, I was surprised to learn that our own company sends our own people bogus phishing things to train us not to click on bogus phishing things.
That's great. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well. Apparently some intern got caught the other day. I don't know. But yeah, this is an actual thing that IT departments do, and it's an active thing.
For sure. And I think one reason it's helpful, in addition to sort of training yourself to take a second look, having mechanisms in place to report phishes is really important. If an employee doesn't know how to go about doing that, they're just not going to. But if there's a quick and easy way that they can forward something or press a button and they know what to do, even if a phish is successful, even if, you know, an attacker gets into a network, if the IT department knows about it right away, they can take action right away.
What I hear you saying is, if you get caught and you do actually click on one of these things, fess up.
Right. If you click something, say something.
Lily Hain Newman, she's a security staff writer at Wired. Lily, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Sleepaway camp looms large in the American imagination. Maybe you went or you send your kids there. This summer, 14 million American kids are going to head off to roughly 14,000 different camps. But the scene has changed a whole bunch since summer camps first came to be. Today, for our series Summer, brought to you by Marketplace's Ryan Kaloff, looks at how a summertime labor of love turned into a whole industry.
It's a perfect summer day in western Massachusetts, and Dan Zenkel is watching soccer drills on one of his three outdoor fields.
So that is the greatest woman soccer player of all time, supervising a bunch of kids.
The woman running the drill is two-time Olympic gold medalist and World Cup winner Mia Hamm. Landing her was great for Zenkel, who owns this place, the Berkshire Soccer Academy for Girls.
Is that a microphone?
It is.
Hello.
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 This is Morgan Miller.
And Lizzie McGrath.
Reporting live on the Soccer Academy.
It's the girls' first time at camp, but they definitely want to come back next year.
Because it's amazing.
It's awesome.
A lot of camps these days are specialized. Soccer camp, coding camp, language camp. More and more, Zenkel says, parents want their kids to come away with a hard skill. Camp today is an $18 billion industry, and tuition's been increasing steadily for decades. Many sleepaway camps now cost more than $10,000 for the summer. That's a long way from camping's origin. The concept took off as a response to rapid industrialization at the turn of the 20th century.
You have a burgeoning labor class. Children go to work in factories.
Gary Zola of the American Jewish Archives has written about early camps. One group called theirs a vacation for, quote, tired young women wearing out their lives in an almost endless drudgery for wages. Zola says wealthy benefactors would bring kids up from tenements and poor city neighborhoods.
This really injects new life and new vigor into the camping movement.
Back then, most camps were run by teachers as a second summer job. The business started changing for an unexpected reason: President Eisenhower's interstate highway system.
These new highways will have a far-reaching economic impact on the entire nation.
The interstate highway system made these previously very inaccessible properties more accessible, and so all of a sudden the property values started to rise.
That's Dan Zenkel again. He says this drove up costs immensely. Camps that couldn't attract kids started going out of business or selling their real estate. Then, in the 80s and 90s, you started seeing classic consolidation.
There were about half the number of camps in 1998 that there were in 1970, and the size of the camp was about 2 to 2.5 times larger.
These days, you often see 600 or 700 kids at a co-ed camp. While we may think of running camp as an avocation, it's now a year-round business. Camp directors spend the other three seasons preparing for summer. Tom Rosenberg is CEO of the industry trade group, the American Camp Association.
I have two business degrees. Was briefly a banker. Then coming out of grad school, my camp director that I grew up with called me and said, please come help him run camp.
Dan Zenkel says the camp business can be pretty lucrative.
The margin on a camper, once you've covered your costs, is probably 60%. They get very profitable. You know, camps with, say they have a gross of anywhere from 2.5 to 5 million, you can count on a 25 to 30% margin.
Personnel is the biggest expense, Zenkel says, followed by food. But the greatest fixed cost is still that beautiful perch on the edge of a lake. Business aside, says Tom Rosenberg, you don't do this work unless you really care.
Camp experiences are just amazing ways to inspire kids to think beyond themselves and think beyond today.
Rosenberg has no interest in being a banker again, he says. But in his new line of work, the MBA helps. In the Berkshires, I'm Ryan Kaloff for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which political turnabout is fair play. You have all seen the pictures by now, I'm sure, of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie sitting on that empty beach over the 4th of July, a beach empty because of the budget impasse that had shut down the state's government. Christie was unapologetic. He said he got to use the beach because it was next to a house that he got to use as governor, which gets us to this. There is now a bill pending in the New Jersey legislature that would require that house be available as a rental to the general public. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 94 points on this Friday, 0.4%. NASDAQ up 63 points, 1% there. S&P 500 climbed 15.6% on a jobs day Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourself a great weekend, all right? This is APM.